Welcome to this morning's podcast. I am delighted to be here in the office of Dr. Graeme Finlay in UCD in the School of Politics and International Relations. And Dr. Finlay is going to talk to us about the work of Benedict Anderson today. And I have to apologise to Dr. Finlay because I kind of pounced on him and asked him to take part. And the reason that I really wanted you to be involved, I suppose, is because you have been so involved in the Politics and Society course. And I really felt that this particular resource wouldn't be complete without having you on board because you have already been so engaged in the course so far. So thank you.
Well, thanks very much. I am delighted that the politics and society subject is being rolled out. I've been commenting on it for years. It is it's been a wonderful I think experience for a lot of the students. It's really great to see the students engaged with it. And I'm a philosopher by background, but I now work as a political theorist, which is a lot pretty much the same thing, only in a politics department. And philosophers and theorists ask questions about how we conceive of things, how we should conceive of things, you know, what should follow. And it is great to have that kind of thing discussed by students amongst themselves more than anything else through the politics and society subject. So in all my encounters with the actual students who are studying this, maybe people like you, it's always been great to have to see how keen and interested and smart and how much people have to say about these issues for people in general, but also specifically for living in Ireland.
So, and I also must apologize because I know Benedict Anderson isn't somebody who you're particularly like interested in your work or utilize his theories an awful lot in your work. But I just really, as I said, I wanted you to take part. But I think that's kind of a good kind of a piece of advice for our listeners as well, is you don't necessarily have to be a genius in relation to some particular theorist's work in order to be able to grasp some of the concepts. So we're just going to have a very kind of informal, laid-back discussion today about Benedict Anderson and some of kind of his main thoughts, I suppose, about nationalism. But first, if you don't mind, I'm just going to give a little bit of background about yourself and what you're interested in. So Dr. Finlay, you're obviously here at the School of Politics and International Relations at UCD. You're actually Canadian originally, though.
Yes, I was.
So you have all kinds of interesting thoughts, I assume, when it comes to nationalism, when we're talking about it later. But you spent time in Princeton in 2009 working on the Education for Cosmopolitan Citizenship Program. You were also the principal investigator on two UCD European Commission projects. One was about fostering human rights among European policies, and the other one was barriers to European Union citizenship. And your interests include political thought, citizenship, development, education, theory and politics of human rights, as well as migration and development. So quite a broad spectrum of things that you're interested in there, which is fantastic. And also, you are in Irish media an awful lot. You tend to be on various radio shows and talk shows discussing Irish politics and the ins and outs of that. So
actually, I wish people asked me more about Irish politics. I'm an Irish citizen as well, thanks to my grandfather's leaving here. And again, I think that comes to questions of identity. And people, because of my accent, rarely ask me to talk about Irish politics as much as American politics. I'm not even American, but I play one on the radio. But yeah, one of the great things about living in Ireland is people ask academics questions. And so I have a regular slot on the Moncrief program where I answer questions from psychology to physics to economics to
very good. Interesting. I'd say it's incredibly interesting
And I learn a lot. And it's the conversation with people. It's listeners who send in the questions. Listeners like you, right, who ask these questions. And in fact, I spent a lot of time talking to primary school children who ask the most amazing questions, including about the issues which arise from Anderson's work, about who we are, you know, what are our obligations, you know, how does this work? And so it's just been a real privilege to be able to have a conversation with people.
The really great thing about young people is the younger they are, the less afraid they are of sounding stupid. You know, I kind of think, I see fellow PhD students who are too afraid to ask a question because they're afraid that they're going to look like they're silly because they should have already known the answer, or, you know, like, so it's funny how those kind of things kind of hold us back.
Yeah, that's right. And that is great. And that's why I love talking, you know, to kids as young as second class, where I get the most brilliant questions. And one of the things I always tell my students, and I've experienced in my own life, is I don't understand is a great question. I often don't understand things. I read books which have been really influential, are great books like Benedict Anderson's Imagine Communities, over and over and over again, and I learn something from them all every single time. So the kind of books you might encounter in a politics and society course. And that's, you know, one of the reasons I like my job and I like talking to people is I'm always learning, and I learn probably more from my students and their questions, including places where I'm not clear about something or the person who we're talking about isn't clear about something. I learn probably more from them than they learn from me.
Yeah. So. Well, hopefully our listeners today will learn a little bit about Benedict Anderson. So I'll give a little bit of background about him. So unfortunately, Benedict Anderson passed away in 2015. He was a political scientist and a historian, best known for his 1983 book, which you just mentioned there, called Imagined Communities, which is about nationalism. He was a professor at Cornell University, which is an Ivy League university in the States. But he also spent a lot of time in Indonesia. And he's quite famous. I guess he became, one of the reasons he became so famous was because he wrote a thing called the Cornell Paper. So we might talk a little bit about that later on, which was a quite controversial. And actually, he was expelled from Indonesia for writing this paper, which kind of exposed stuff about the government and debunked the story about a coup in the 1960s. So that's kind of interesting in its own right. But he was born in China. His father worked out there in a British outpost in the maritime customs, I think. But his father was Anglo-Irish, so he had an Irish background, and he actually came to live in Ireland when he was about 9 years old, I think, when they had to leave China. And I'm sure that this has to have contributed to his understanding of nationalism, and that has definitely had to have it. But even though they were descended from a Scottish plantation family, members of the family were also involved in the Catholic Rebellion. So he would certainly have had a very interesting kind of outlook, I suppose, on Irish nationalism, for sure. So when he was young, he was incredibly bright. He went to Eton College, where I think Prince William and Prince Harry also went to.
I'm not even sure. Some of them, they probably did, actually.
I think they did. But he won a scholarship while he was there, and he was sent off to Cambridge, where he started to kind of pick up Marxist theory and became anti-imperialist. And after his experience in Indonesia, when he had lived out there and had been asked to leave, he became very interested in the American experience and the Vietnam War, and looking at the origins of nationalism, kind of from there, I suppose, as well. So he was elected a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 1994. And then, as we said, he died in 2015. He's survived by his two adopted sons, which are of Indonesian origin. An incredibly interesting story, just as a human being. I mean, like, there's an awful lot of stuff that has happened in his life. So where to start, really? I suppose if we try to talk about the book, can you tell us a little bit of kind of the background of the book, Imagined Communities, and why it's important and why it was so groundbreaking?
It's an interesting book. And again, I think you're right. His life in many ways shows why he might be well placed to write this book. He wasn't just from one place, right? And he didn't just have one identity. And he had absorbed a lot of the political thinking, which comes out in the book. So the book comes out in the 1980s, and there already is a certain literature on nationalism. You know, one of the things we know from the history of the 20th century, and well, the 19th century and the 20th century, is the rise of nationalism as a way of people thinking about themselves, and then accordingly as the way in which nations behave, right? I mean, thinking about things in terms of nations, right? Nation, the word, is based on the idea of birth, people who are born something, part of this nation, right? As opposed to a state, right? Mm-hmm. And so when people talk about the nation state, it's a state which is identified with a particularly, perhaps ethnically understood group of people. And so that, I don't think I need to tell anybody, led to some pretty horrific things in the 19th and 20th century, as in the name of an ethno-state. We have, I know it's almost the end of the discussion, you know, things like World War II, right, and the Holocaust.
Yes.
So
yeah, I know we were chatting to Ben Tonra, kindly came on the podcast and spoke about, God, I've forgotten who, I think Huntington actually, yeah. He spoke about, yeah. And again, he said, as soon as you mention Hitler, you've lost the argument. But I just think it's something that's very, very relatable. It's kind of the ultimate kind of example.
Sure.
So maybe if you do want to talk about that,
and
so
actually,
that is, you know, like he was trying to create this one ethnically kind of distinct kind of state.
I mean, I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on Hitler. There's so many to talk about Hitler that you might even be boring people, but certainly I don't know anything about, really, I don't really know the basics about Hitler. But it's the idea that we should think about our political lives first and foremost in terms of an ethnic identity which is supposed to be grounded in some biological fact. Germans are a certain people. They're all members of some biological ethnicity, and that this matters, right, politically, to the point where you would invade other countries to have more space for the German people or the folk, you know, obviously is a very, very dangerous concept, especially if no other considerations, like other people's human rights, right, are opposed to them. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the absolute horrors of World War II and World War I, where for slightly less aggressive, but only slightly less aggressive, nationalistic fervor, countries went to war, and which led to an almost unparalleled number of deaths in the countries involved, led to what we have now as our international system, which I have spent increasingly time thinking about, particularly human rights. I mean, the whole international system in the UN Charter of non-invasion of countries and of allowing countries to self-determine is the background in many ways to Benedict Anderson's thought. I mean, how did we get from a long period where there are lots of different ways of thinking about states and why they went to war and how they governed themselves, which was radically different from the way we think of them now, to the point where in international law, in the UN Charter, states are the unit of which has rights.
Yes.
Where we talk about the world divided up into states, those states have borders. We might spend a lot of time sorting out what those borders are, but those are the states are the ones talking to each other in the UN. It's not individuals who are represented in the General Assembly, it's states. Mm-hmm. And so how do we get there? How do we get to the place where everybody thinks of themselves as a state, and many people think of their states in a patriotic way, right? Now, this may be based on their ethnic identity. This is very, very difficult to do in immigrant countries like the United States, Canada, Brazil, where, you know,
and increasingly
descent,
other countries,
increasing
that,
other countries.
Like Ireland, for example.
Like Ireland, yes. I mean, Ireland has gone through a relatively rapid increase of migration, which I think we'll want to talk about, because Irish identity is changing, mm-hmm. whether some people like it or not. But, you know, you can't see it as a strict country of descent in the U.S. and Canada's case, just because people came from all over. And there is maybe a difference between a historical European state or a Southeast Asian state, which sees its past, at least, as having the same people in the same place, in the words
of
James Joyce.
I guess one of the most interesting things about Anderson's work is that he took a completely different view, whereas originally all of this work that you talked about that pre-existed about nationalism was all very Eurocentric, that focused on Europe as a place of nationalities. His work focused on America.
Indeed.
And Brazil and the Americas, basically.
But especially Southeast Asia. As you said, he was an Indonesian specialist until that became difficult. And then he switched to Thailand. But most of his research, his actual research, before he had the theory of nationalism, was in the Southeast of Asia. And that's one of the great things about the book. Many of the examples are drawn not from Europe, not from the United States, but from... in fact, there's a real neglect, you might even say, of Europe and the United States in favor of many examples drawn from East Asia, Southeast Asia, and also from other parts of the world, from Africa, not seen simply as a decolonizing area, but as a country, Africa's not a country, people, as a region or as a continent, which has a history before European colonization.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really, really, that's one of the exciting things about the book. It also problematized these stories we tell each other in a way which was caught up in a lot of the books which are around at this time. The people you would associate with this approach, this critical approach to talk about nation and history, would be Benedict Anderson, but also the historian E.J. Hobsbawm, who, with some other people, talked about the invention of tradition. And so all these traditions which people like to tell themselves have been there since time immemorial, right? Always about the same people in the same place. And again, James Joyce's work, which I realize is difficult, but, you know, mm-hmm. is really good in Ulysses about problematizing this as well for Ireland. But, you know, these stories we tell ourselves about the same people living in the same place, doing the same things forever, that's why they're so important to us. That's why we do them. were actually of relatively recent invention. And so it's the idea that these things were invented in the trade, we might call them socially constructed, right? Was quite important for people to hear because, you know, as Anderson notes in, so his book is called Imagined Communities. And that's what he says. Nations are imagined communities.
So, but he's saying that they're not fake communities.
But they're not fake communities. They're real communities. People who will never meet each other, even in Ireland, and Ireland is a very small place. It's amazing how often you run into people over and over and over again in Ireland. I'm sure everyone has experienced that.
I know, because there is a kind of a theory that there's 6 degrees of separation in the world.
Yeah.
That we're all interconnected some way, that I know you and you know somebody else, and it'll all come back in 6 degrees.
I think in Ireland, it's like
2 or 3 for sure.
It's true in Canada. I mean, I'm from the second largest country in the world. It's enormous. It's ridiculous how big it is. We don't quite have a park the size of Ireland. We flooded an area the size of the UK, which is bigger than Ireland, mm-hmm. to power a dam. We have a lot of space in Canada. But there are only 30-something million of us. And it's amazing how almost every Canadian who meets each other, even if they're from thousands of miles apart, will know someone in common. We might even be related, which happened to me, through Ireland, actually, a couple times in Canada. So these are communities. These are real communities, but they're imagined. So it only works because even though we won't meet every single other Irish person in our lives, that we see ourselves as having some kind of fellowship in community, and that has some kind of relevance.
So I, for example, see myself subconsciously. I've grown up to understand that I am in some way connected to people in Donegal and people in the west coast of Ireland and people who are in the diaspora in the UK, and that I have a commonality and a community with these people. So right. We're all trained to believe, and you as a Canadian were probably trained, I guess, is that you were inculcated as part of being a citizen within a country to know that you're part of this wider community somehow.
It's true, and it is really, really interesting. I think that's right.
What he's talking about is that only works once everybody ties into it, right?
Right, I mean, it's imagined, right? Mm. And so I think the main focus of his book and why it's different from some previous studies of nationalism, many of which were quite individualist, but also some of which weren't quite so individualist and saw nations as things out in the world, took the view that it was a fabrication, right? Because this endless nation hasn't existed since time immemorial, that the people of the 12th, 13th century wouldn't have seen themselves in that terms, that meant that this was fake, right? Yes. Or imaginary in the bad sense.
Or imposed, or false, right? by a monarchy or something like that, kind of stating, you know...
That's one of the most interesting dynamics of Anderson's work, actually, is the imposed versus, you know, the top-down imposed versus bottom-up spontaneous. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things people are critical of and is quite striking about his work. But you're right, these things are promoted through being in school, and that's something that Anderson attends to. My education in Canada had particular characteristics which made me self-identify as a Canadian. I then went to the United States as a graduate student and identified with America to the point where I pretend to be an American on the radio, talk about American politics, not as much as I used to. But America doesn't identify back. And I was actually scheduled for deportation at one point. It's all fine now. Well, I don't know, maybe it isn't. Like, Irish me is now illegal in the United States and would be kept out if I was only Irish, because I have two passports. Whereas Canadian me is completely welcome.
Okay.
Don't worry, the Secretary of State in the United States knows about this. It's a deal we have. For example, in Canada, we were conscious that we were different from Americans. Primary school, one of my first primary school, was named after Princess Margaret, who was one of the more colorful members of the royal family. And we had pictures of the Queen. The Queen is on our money and things like that. She can still be the Queen of Canada if she ever gets kicked out of the UK. And that distinguished us from Americans. And we're also distinct culturally. We have, you know, some different ways of doing things and different political and social systems and things like that. And a lot of that is the way in which the state consciously reproduces itself.
Can we go way back to the origins of nationalism and what the world would have looked like before there were recognized nations.
Well, I think, yeah, it's important to talk about the story insofar as he tells a story that, that Anderson tells. I mean, one, I just on that last point, I think I'm going to take something from Twitter, which I think says this extremely well. A lot of people, and this is going on in all sorts of areas of controversy, whether it's people who identify as transgender or people who identify as a particular ethnic group, discussions around membership of the traveling community, which has recently been recognized as an ethnic group. Many of these claims are on the basis that ethnicity, race, gender is socially constructed, mm-hmm. right? It was something we do together. It's not something where you can hold up a sort of, light pen to people or put their blood through some kind of hemoanalysis. I'm messing up the science here. A gas chamber and awful choice of words actually. And find their travelerness or their mm-hmm. gender or their Irishness in there somewhere.
Yes.
These are socially constructed, and it has to do with something we do together. As someone on Twitter quite appropriately said, socially constructed is not a synonym for imaginary, right? Mm-hmm. These things are real. They do things in the world. They affect how people react, for example, to travelers. So you can run people who are members of the traveling community's sort of DNA through sequencers as much as you like, right? That is not going to determine how people react to them when they try to enter a pub, right? Mm-hmm. Or when they, are looking for culturally appropriate accommodation, right?
Yes.
That's not how society doesn't do a blood test before it decides how to treat people who are mm-hmm. members of the traveling community. And that's why they can reasonably and have eventually, after a long struggle, ask for recognition as a minority ethnic group, and anti-traveler sentiment be viewed as racism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, these discussions, which are really roiling our society to a degree which it can be problematic, Anderson can help us, I think through some of these things. So he takes nationalism, he takes nations extremely seriously, despite seeing them as socially constructed. So, but you said, go back to the world before. Well, in many ways, it's sort of, where do you want to go? How long is a piece of string?
How did people start coming together as nations? Was it, as we talk about, imposed? Was it like a geographical thing where people were kind of like, okay, well, this is our territory and
right.
we're under this leadership here and now we start to see ourselves as a community? Or was it less kind of smooth than that?
So Anderson is prepared to go pretty far back. In some ways. I mean, usually, depending on the country he's talking about, he might talk about the Middle Ages. Right? In some other context, it might be, the early modern period, which is, there's always debates over when that is, mm-hmm. 16th, 17th century to the 18th century, mm-hmm. beginning of the 18th century. And he has some explanatory factors, and one of the interesting things about Anderson is, as you say, he was influenced by Marxist thought. His brother, Perry Anderson, is actually a very important Marxist thinker in his own right, and anti-imperialist thought, which in many ways was produced by the kind of struggles of former colonies, like Ireland, arguably, mm-hmm. to establish themselves as countries in their own right.
So he felt like, he spoke about Brazil a little bit and about how when the Spanish colony became its own country after that, that was kind of the birth of nationalism within Brazil. Was that the point that he was
Brazil
trying to make?
Brazil and other Latin American countries.
Yes.
And So
that when the colonizers left, the people were left there and then they had to decide what their nation was going to be. Then they were in control of their own community at that point and were able to kind of develop their own nation state from that point on.
Yeah. That was quite recent. That was the beginning of the 19th century. And before that, it would be very hard for people in Venezuela in the book, he spends more time talking about the Bolivarian republics, the Spanish-speaking republics of Gran Colombia, which eventually fragments into Venezuela, Colombia, and all the ones which were liberated by Bolivar and others, including a number of Irish people or people of Irish descent, in the early 19th century, who a few decades before, and certainly a century before, would not have seen them, would have seen themselves as part of the Spanish Empire. Many of these people had some complex relationship to the Spanish Empire. I mean, in all of these cases, including in Europe, he has various factors which he thinks are important. One is, so none of these, I think, it's really important for us to I mean, this might help. I realize this sounds really fancy as a sort of philosophical distinction, but this might help people when they're thinking about anything, right? None of them are necessary in the sense that the change wouldn't have happened without them, mm-hmm. right? I think. I mean, it's not entirely clear what's going on. And none of them are sufficient, right? So that if they're there, this change towards a nation state conception of where we are would have happened, right? That's mm-hmm. a philosophical thing. So he's open for alternative stories and different ways in which these could have happened. Nevertheless, he's criticized for maybe having too powerful a set of explanations. But anyway, what he sees is the decline of previous certainties, dynasties basically being the same, not the soap opera from the 70s and 80s, but royal houses or imperial thrones or...
So, for example, in North Korea, they have a dynasty.
They have a dynasty, which is, a very specific one. Yeah, which is, succession goes from father to son or father to daughter or whatever. And these dynastic families would have had a grip on the politics and the power in most of the states we're talking about. The decline of, or at least threats to their rule, which leads to the particular form the nationalism takes. That's one factor. So you're not loyal to Spain, you're loyal to the King of Spain, right? Or the Emperor, the Spanish Emperor, because the Spanish Empire was huge and diverse. And this is an empire which very often, is much, much more spread out and covers lots of people who speak loads of different languages, right? In the case of the Spanish Empire, their holdings, these holdings were, thousands of miles away. The Spanish emperors would have also had, the Low Countries until the Netherlands revolts, right? Mm-hmm. and so forth. They didn't have territories which were neatly bounded by seas and mountain ranges and lines
drawn
on a map.
They just had loyal subjects.
Right. Yeah, they had subjects all over the world. I mean, the British Empire famously, the sun never set on it because it was all the way around the globe. Right? Mm-hmm. And Algeria was until the 60s and part of France, part of France the way Bordeaux is part of France. Mm-hmm. So that it's the decline of them, or at least threats to their rule, which lead them to make some changes. But the threats come from another thing he focuses on, which is language. Mm-hmm. The idea that we all speak the same language, and it's not blood. Blood seems to follow language, right? Mm-hmm. It's we all speak the same language, and accordingly, we're the same people.
Right. So that was a big part of his, like the printing press, the invention of the printing press. That was a huge kind of a element of how he felt that the idea of nationalism spread, because it gave everybody, as you talk about, this common language mm-hmm. where people all of a sudden, me in Dublin and somebody in Donegal and somebody in Clare, now all of a sudden we're reading the same newspapers, we have access to the same books, and we have access to the same rhetoric about what it is to be a citizen of Ireland, and the same then across whatever nations you're talking about. You could apply that to any nation.
What's exciting about it is Marx, and I know Marx is also in the politics of society mm-hmm. subject, right, pays a lot of attention to what we call in the business, the material aspects of how society and economics function, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's print capitalism he thinks is particularly important. It's the invention of the printing press allows capitalism in its development to create a market, or to find a market for all the vast expansion of books mm-hmm. which occurs.
Power
you go from just a tiny
what he talked
few
about,
of books.
Yeah. He said powerful languages, a power language, for example, a language of power was the Queen's English, because it was so commonplace within print, and Latin as well, because it was so common within print that it became a currency, I suppose, for creating nations, because, people had access, more people were inclined to speak English if everything was printed in English.
Right.
So people would kind of form.
There's this explosion of books after the expansion of the invention of the printing press. I mean, just absolutely massive. And they'd run this one thing in millions of books, you know, in the 16th century, you know, which more than anything allow people to communicate with that. He spends a lot of time talking about the newspaper, as I think you said, you know, which is, as he say, as someone else said, a bestseller, which is released every day.
Right? Yes.
And I love newspapers. I get loads of newspapers. The, you know, which brings people together because people do have to have a common language. I mean, their printing presses in all the languages, but if you think about, I mean, again, it's very easy to go focus on countries I'm more familiar with. You know, in Italy, there are all these dialects, and there were up until the 19th century, certainly, and on into the 20th century, which were mutually incomprehensible. The same thing's true of China. I mean, people, there are vast numbers of languages spoken in China, many, many ethnic groups.
Well, it's the same thing in Irish.
People
Irish
in Shanghai
like
can't
Irish,
necessarily communicate, or Guangzhou
like
can't
communicate
Connacht with
Irish
people.
And Munster Irish
exactly.
And Ulster Irish are all kind of slightly different dialects.
I have to say, as an outsider, this is one of the most amazing things. It's like, I really wish our Gweligori in this country, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, could get along.
And just come together with some common...
Because the number of people who say, oh, well, they don't really speak Irish in other group of
really
Irish speakers
important
here.
Important to Anderson's view of how language kind of impacted, because he said that something that binds people together as part of a nation is that having to come together and decide on a mutual language, which is funny that that never actually happened in Ireland. And I suppose the reason that it didn't happen was because before we had a chance to come together and do exactly what you're suggesting, which is to have a commonplace set dialect for the Irish language, we were
just
colonized.
Just impose Leinster Irish on everybody else, right? You know.
So we were English was imposed on us, so that became our first language, and then that didn't give us a chance. Sorry, interesting enough, what Anderson says, the three paradoxes of nationalism are that nationalism to him is a recent and modern creation, despite most people thinking that it's old and timeless. That nationalism is a universal concept because everyone belongs to a nation. And nationalism is an idea so influential that people are willing to die for it. So that for him kind of encapsulates what nationalism is about. And that it is this recent thing for him as opposed to being this ancient thing that we've all tied into, that it is actually... And that's interesting, isn't it? That he thinks of it as being a very, very recent thing.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think it's... So I think you're right. There are all these paradoxes, which I think they are paradoxes only if you're wedded to this idea of sort of primordial nationalism, all the things which he is in a way, I mean, I'm not going to say deconstructed, but he sort of pulls the rug out from under by just looking at the actual history of these things. So again, I mean, the factors seem to be threats to dynastic power, print, and specifically capitalism, and then the tension between people sort of opting into a national self-conception. Often, you know, and again, these are complex things. There might be resistance. So in Italian, right, what you're getting basically is, and this is how the Tuscans see it, and I think occasionally how other people see it, you know, Tuscan forms of ways of speaking Italian sort of made the language of a very recently created state, the 1860s, say, 50s and 60s. And people resisted that. People still speak Venegatsu in Venice. One of the great things... Why you might want to be an academic, one of the great things about being me is I get to travel to Venice twice a year, and I could go more often, but my family calls me home, you know, to teach. And there, people still, you'll hear people speaking Venegatsu, which is the dialect in Venice. It is very, very different from Italian. Mm-hmm. It sounds to my ears more like Spanish than Italian, but what do I know? So, you know, there'd be resistance to that, but there are also benefits to being part of these wider communities. Mm-hmm. And so there's a bottom-up sort of, you know, people just opting in, reading these books and communicating with each other. But at the same time, so the other tension is from what he calls official nationalism, which is what the elites do when they're in threat. There's the threat of them being displaced and maybe some more popular, or we might even say in the context of our contemporary politics, populist forms of self-government, which will marginalize the royal family, right, or the aristocrats, or whatever. And so there you get the sort of conscious or unconscious, you know, to whatever extent, and I think this is an interesting question, production of a nationalist narrative, which, say, in the case of Thailand, you know, ties it to the royal house in a way such that, you know, you can go to jail for criticizing or being even seen to insult, right, the king of Thailand, or the emperor of Thailand, at all, right? I mean, in the slightest possible way. Mm-hmm. The king, I should know this. I keep going back and forth on this. And so this official nationalism, which is reproduced through bureaucratic structures, through opportunities for people, and through educational establishments, is one of the driving forces. And these things are in tension. And one of the criticisms of Anderson is that he actually is insufficiently critical, both of nationalism generally, but maybe specifically of the official nationalism, which obviously we could think of other ways of doing things. Right? Mm-hmm. The other thing which I think is an important concept we get from Anderson, and if we look at read the book, and I encourage you all to read the book, it's very readable, you'll learn a lot. It's not that difficult. It's heavy, but you don't need like scientific jargon. It's very free of jargon, actually, mm-hmm. Insofar as it has any jargon at all. Pilgrimages is a great word from the book, which he talks about. So he's often talking about people on the move and what their opportunities were. And so he calls these people pilgrims. Because another thing which declines, he thinks, is the sense of religious world orders. And mm-hmm. so, which are often defined in terms of pilgrimages to Rome, to Jerusalem, to Mecca, on the part of religious adherents who see themselves as part of the same group, right? In Islam, we have the notion of the Ummah, which is the community of all believers. Mm-hmm. And that's an imagined community. You're never going to meet all the billions of Muslims out there in the world, mm-hmm. right? But it's not a national community. In fact, one of the appeals of Islam to many, many people is that it doesn't have any place for ethnicity
nations,
right, ultimately, and that's an interesting aspect of Islam. So when he's talking about the emergence of some of these movements, especially from below, he talks about how the Creoles, which would have been the word in the 19th century, especially in sort of South America, Central America, and even other places, for European-descended colonists, who by dint of their being born in Latin America or South America or whatever, could never become big figures in what we all call in these areas the metropole, mm-hmm. Spain. They can be the most talented and educated or even rich person from what is now Venezuela, mm-hmm. pretty much in the news these days. They're never going to get a job running an area, you know, Andalusia, right, yes. in Spain. And this is an example Anderson uses. And so it's where can you move? What are your opportunities, which often affect how people think of themselves, mm-hmm. but then also what elites, what the dynasts, what the power structures do to create this notion of the identity of the nation, of this imagined community, and the state structures, like schools. And he points out that in a lot of different contexts, maybe at different times, you know, the state grows. Another part of the story is the state grows in its functions. And so, whereas before there might have been one person sent out from Spain to run huge parts of South America, mm-hmm. right? Now suddenly, and you see it in Indonesia and you see it in other places, you know, there's the tax collector, there's the schools, you know, someone's got to teach in the schools, someone's got to run the schools, mm-hmm. There's the census, there's all these departments which need educated workers, and this is a place where people can gain skills, gain education, be educated for, but also feel themselves part of the state. And so often when we see in Southeast Asia, you see large entities like Indochine, the French Indochina, fragment into the countries we now know as Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam. It's often parallels the rise of seeing Khmer, in the case of Cambodia, as the national language, as the basis of a community of Khmer speakers who would have seen themselves as simply, if they thought of themselves at all, as part of this imperialist construct. And he doesn't neglect the role of empire in this at all, which is very, very important. Mm-hmm. But this imperialist construct, which is French Indochina, and further, they might see themselves as the hinterland of the main centers in Hanoi, mm-hmm. right, and Saigon. So.
Yes. Well, listen, Professor Finlay, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast today. Yes.
Can I say one more thing about you about how this affects about Ireland,
yes,
Irish
yeah,
things?
Please
because
do,
I think
yeah.
it's really important for us as Irish people, and I want to include myself in the Irish Imagine community, to think about these things. I mean, the example from us would be Dermot McMurrough, if I recall correctly, is often viewed as some sort of traitor to Ireland because he invited the Normans in, right? Mm. That is a massive piece of anachronism. He would never have seen himself as a sort of Irish person who was opposed in some sense in terms of borders, because the borders were all over the place,
yes,
right? But they weren't on the Irish Sea, right? As opposed to the English crown, right? And so to see him as a traitor, right, is massively anachronistic.
Not the way the setup was back then. It was a completely different context.
It was the warring bunch of kingdoms all through the, what we might call, although you don't say it here, the British archipelago. We say these islands, right?
Yes.
All these warring kingdoms who are always after each other, you know, who wouldn't have seen themselves in a national or a nation state identity. Similarly, Anderson's example is the barons who forced King John to sign the Magna Carta are seen as sort of heroes of human rights and free rights of English people, right? They spoke French. They would not have recognized this stuff at all. It's, you know, as the Daily Show actually once said, you know, power to the extremely rich people, you know. And so we need to, I mean, we don't want to underestimate the role in which Anderson's complicated history allows us to learn about ourselves and take a more critical look to our own identity, our own relationship. Because again, if our identity is socially constructed, then we have a role and a critical, reflective, self-conscious role in how it's constructed. And I'm just going to tell you one story about my own relationship to this. I talk about migration a lot. I talk about it on the radio. I get all sorts of dog's end of abuse from the relatively small, I think, community of Irish racists on Twitter. And it becomes quite clear when you're sort of getting attacked by these people. Or Lenny Abramson, our celebrated filmmaker, is attacked for not being Irish, right? And never being able to be Irish, mm-hmm. because he's a Jewish, you know, he's a Jewish-Irish person, right? It emerges when you talk to these people that if your ancestors or even some of them arrived after 1170, they don't think you're Irish, right? And you're not Irish and you don't get a say in these kinds of things, right?
It's
when I say, well, you're really selling out your, you know, mound-raising, new-grange-creating ancestors.
For me, as somebody who's, and I've spoken with various academics about this throughout the course of this podcast, when you're in the privileged position of not knowing what it's like to be the outsider, it's very, very difficult to understand that that is the case. You know, you look at somebody like Phil Lynott, or he has come up in the podcast a couple of times, and, you know, you think, God, I mean, he's a huge symbol of Ireland.
Yeah.
But I guess there are people out there who
There are people out there. Happily, I don't think there are too many of them. They've got about 4 political parties to choose from at this point. So I won't name them in case I get... But, you know, it is, you know, and this is bad history. It's bad science.
Yes.
It's bad politics.
Because mm-hmm.
I think bad politics and bad science always follows from bad history and bad science.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I don't know what it's like for people to have their identity understood in, again, what we call some kind of primordial way, where people are walking around and saying, I am descended from Nile of the Nine Hostages, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whose descent is incredible. Like, 1 in 9 Irish males bears a genetic marker of Nile of the Nine Hostages.
He was
a king in Ulster quite some time ago. Back, apparently, had 9 hostages. Actually, he had many more than 9 hostages. But he was a particularly fertile king in that there's a particular DNA marker which is found in a huge percentage of people of Irish descent. It's found in Skip Henry Louis Gates Jr. Skip Gates, to people who know him, which I don't. Who's a very, very prominent African-American historian, sort of, and studies person, academic, and basically a celebrity in the United States. And when they did his genetic ancestry, they found out he was descended from Nile of the Nine Hostages, right? I think that there's something really toxic, something really false and stupid about these primordial notions of identity, which are also quite dangerous and led to some of the really serious concerns we've had. But I think we start with it being false.
Mm-hmm.
And I think once we see that, And that's what Anderson brings us, right? What's, you know, an awareness that we, you know, if we're engaging in that kind of talk, we're trading, we're doing on false premises, and we're engaging in a politics which ultimately, even though it's important and we need to take it seriously, has to be understood in this critical way. So by raising at least these questions and an awareness that this certainty, which some people unfortunately cling to, by undermining it, I think Anderson's done us all a service.
Yes. Well, listen, once again, thank you so very much, Dr. Finlay, for coming onto the podcast today and speaking about Benedict Anderson. I'd just like to finish up the podcast sometimes by asking the academics if they have any advice for any budding philosophers out there who might be thinking about, you know, getting involved in history or political science or something like that. What would your advice be to them?
I was that person. I remember reading a lot of philosophy when I was a teenager and not understanding it. If you're asking these questions, I've talked to 7-year-olds who ask philosophical questions. I think they come very naturally to us. So pick up a book and start reading it. It could be Anderson, it could be Aristotle, it could be Plato, it could be Nietzsche.
But I mean, don't be intimidated by it.
Don't be intimidated about it. I don't get it all. I have to read these things every year, and I've taught Aristotle 20-something years in a row. Mm-hmm. I've read it dozens of times. It's these are people who've had the same questions you have, and they've thought about them, and they can help you think. Mm-hmm. Don't stop thinking for yourself, though, and don't stop asking questions. Like I said, 7-year-olds ask me philosophical questions, and we have really good discussions. So it's never too late. Also, there are increasingly things you can do if you want to keep going with this. There's the Young Philosopher Awards, which are sort of like young scientists, only with philosophy. And you could ask your teachers, or you can just put something in. We had an amazing presentation on self-driving cars from a sixth class student, mm-hmm. in the last Young Philosophers Awards. And so keep asking those questions. There are lots of people out there who want to talk to you about it. I find that if you do have these questions, your teachers will be, somebody in your school will be really interested in talking about these things. I've found philosophy clubs all over Dublin City, from Ballyfermot to Ballsbridge. Mm-hmm. And then finally, reach out to academics. I'm always delighted to hear from anybody, from outside of UCD, because I feel like it's not just about my students, who at least are getting a grade and a certification at the end of this. It's all about the conversations we're having with everybody in this country. And that's one of the great things about being in Ireland, is that you can reach out and talk to people, and you'll find that they'll be delighted to talk to you.
Yes. Well, listen, thank you once again, Dr. Finlay. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast this morning.
Thank you.